Yeah. Red and yellow or something
so
like that.
So this is the matter of culture.
Yes, okay.
So, I mean, this is also one other aspect of the issue, that there might be different codes in different cultures for mourning or celebrating things. When it comes to Islam, speaking generally about from the first perspective, the impact of colors on you, we see that there is a kind of karaha, it is dislike to wear black clothing for men.
Mm-hmm.
And
You mean in the usual days? I mean,
yeah, generally
days?
Speaking, okay. wearing black clothing.
Yes.
Unless the exception for the abaya or chador that the ladies wear, or also the turban that the men may use.
Yes, that's right. Okay.
Today is the culture, but previously everybody used to wear turban. I mean, when we're talking about Islam, the time of the Prophet, even in a country like Iran 100 years ago, almost everybody, dignitary people used to wear, turban.
Right.
It was a piece and part of culture. Recently it has changed because of the modern culture. Anyhow, other than those exceptions, generally speaking, wearing black is makruh, it is disliked. Mm-hmm. But there are exceptions to it. We have one of the cultures we see that, for example, Imam Baghir alayhi salam narrates that when Imam Hussein alayhi salam was killed, Bani Hashim and the ladies of Bani Hashim, they wore black in mourning for Imam Hussein alayhi salam at the hot summer and cold winter.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning that so they wore black actually to commemorate, to mourn for Imam Hussein alayhi salam and to remember Imam Hussein. So here, wearing black became a code, an etiquette, actually, for mourning for Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Yes.
And it became part of the culture and the part of the ceremony of Ashura. Then from that perspective, we see that aspect of being disliked is ignored, and because it becomes the part of the ceremony of commemorating. Of course, we don't have any specific hadith to say that you have to or you are recommended to wear black for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. But at the same time, we know that
this is the culture and the custom
of mourning for Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying this because in some other countries, as I said, in their in the funeral ceremony, in their mournings, they may wear white, so they can wear white. But because today, this is a kind of universal culture because of the world being connected to each other.
Yes.
And originally in the Arab world, they used to wear black for Imam Hussein. Later on in Iran, in Pakistan, in different countries that Shia used to live,
mm-hmm.
they also had the culture of wearing black.
Yes.
Now we see that worldwide they wear black for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And because of this, this wisdom in it, our fuqaha say that that karaha and being disliked, that abomination is removed from wearing black in this exception.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Inshallah, 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 you'll find your way.
Sorry, Sheikh, historically speaking, we know that the Arabs used to wear white. And it has so many reasons. Some of them are, even nowadays, you can see generation after generation, usually the Arabs in the Arab continents, their shuyukh, wear white, some of them are related to the customs. The other one might be that the white color works better in the hot weather of the Arab Peninsula and not black one. And all of a sudden, when such a tragedy is going to take place, the people are going to wear the color which is exactly opposite to the mainstream and the main trend of the history of the world. And the opposite of the white might be considered as black. I mean, it might be also a sign of opposition against the mainstream culture of the world on that time, the Arab Peninsula and the Arab kings of the Umayyads on that time. But all in all, we can say that the color black, we can say always, we can say conveys the meaning of a kind of sadness or melancholy, you know, with itself. Yes. It is not a color of happiness or something like that. And because Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam martyrdom is a sad news, so the people usually wear black.
Exactly. I said that it wasn't the typical clothing and garment that people used to wear. Mm-hmm. So they used to wear it in mourning to show that they are in a kind of dark time. They are in suffering. They are in hardship. So it was exceptional clothing. To then people seeing some people wearing black to know that something has happened. And as I said, ladies of Bani Hashim for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, they used to wear black. Yes. Yeah. So it was a sign that something is happening or has happened here.
All right.
It is, and these people are mourning for that.
All right.
So
even now, they just look at the Arab women in the Arab countries like Saudi Arabia, you know, they wear black, you know. Yeah. From tip to toe, you know, they wear black. Before these recent reforms, you know, in the Saudi Arabia, they used to wear black, all the women, okay, with the burqa and
yeah,
you know, that's right.
I said that is different, you know.
Yes.
We talked about generally the general exceptions that exist for the turban, all for the abaya of ladies.
Yes.
Totally speaking, it wasn't that much popular at that time. So, I mean, at the time of the Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Yes.
So at that time, ladies wearing black was the sign that they were mourning. But as I said, as time passes, cultures change. Mm-hmm. And wearing black is sort of popular today for
That's
ladies,
right.
like the chador and abaya that they have, or the abba that the cloak that the scholars usually use, and it is dark. Also, this is one of the exceptions that the kraha is not there. But for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, that was the custom of actually mourning for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, which has the fazila of.
It has become a symbol nowadays.
It's a symbol.
That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, culturally speaking and socially speaking, this is now a famous symbol for the people all across the world, not only Muslim lands, but in the Western world, you could see this siyahi, okay? I mean, this black clothing and the black flags everywhere during the month of Muharram.
And actually, this is how, when we talk about fiqh perspective, this is how the subjects, might have different rulings at different times when the function changes.
All right.
Sometimes a subject has a ruling because of a specific function. The function changes, then the ruling is changed.
Yes.
And this can be one of the examples of that.
That's right. Usually the other customs come, for example, in Iran, in Azerbaijan, we have this, the Sunnah of Yagabandan. Do you know what is it? This Yagabandan is a kind of, we can say, that's right, doing the button of your collar during the month of Muharram. The people wear black.
Okay.
And then the undone buttons or the open buttons of the shirt has to be in respect for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. You know, all in all, when it goes to, as you said, different regions, it might be, we can say...
Yeah, the cultural codes of showing respect and
for Imam al-Hussein,
and mourning for Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Okay. Unfortunately, some deviated groups wanted to change... the legacy of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and wearing black. I could vividly remember, and still, the ISIS members wear black from tip to toe, okay?
Yeah.
So they were black, and somehow they wanted to change the history of wearing black. Am I right? Okay.
That is it has a different story, actually.
Yes.
We have some movements in the history like those who raised against Umayyads and caused the collapse of Umayyads, they used to wear black.
Okay.
And even we have some hadiths that there will be a group of people coming and sort of in a revolutionary act, actually, they will conquer lands. And they have long hair and black clothing and garments.
This is a different story from...
So they wanted to actually claim that we are the embodiment, the manifestation of those hadiths that says that the group of people will come with black clothing, long beard and long hair to establish a kind of Islamic government. So, yeah, this was a... taken from such hadiths that they have, and these hadiths usually in the Sunni books are collected at the time of the uprisings of people, especially Abbasids against Umayyads, that sometimes such hadiths were very common and popular among them.
That's all right.
Yeah.
Some scholars during the history of Islam, some of the mujtahideen and the fuqaha, also has authored some books. The most famous one is Irshadul Ibad. We can say which is written by, say, Ja'far Tabatabai Ha'iri. In one of the chapters of the book, he talks straightly about the recommended act of wearing black clothing for the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein, alayhi salam. As you said, it is not a recommended action, even it is sometimes makruh or not favorable, isn't
in
it?
Itself,
yes. I mean, during the regular days, because it has effects on your soul, on your spirituality or something like that. It brings a kind of maybe negative mood and melancholic lifestyle to you, which is not at all recommended in Islam. But for special occasions like the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein and the other martyrdoms, the people are recommended to do so. Thank you very much, Shaykh, for a nice elaboration. And usually in the Islamic culture and the calendar, the Shiite ones, the people do that up until the end of the month of Safar, which is the, we can say, the demise anniversary of Prophet Muhammad. Usually 2 months of Muharram and Safar, the black color is an inseparable part of the lifestyle of the Shiites all across the world. It was very kind of you, Shaykh, and thank you very much for your elaboration on the black clothing and we can say the black attire and covering center places with black fabric to signify mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. It was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. For more information, please visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanullah. Inna fil jannati nahran min labani Ali
wa Husayn wa Hasan. A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
الله يا الله سبحان الله الله يا الله والحمد لله الله ولا إله إلا
This is part of Imam Khomeini's speech and recommendations to preachers, reciters of elegies and mourners. At this point, we ought to mention that mournings for Imam al-Hussein and lamentation gatherings held in his name must be arranged with due circumspection. No abuse should be made. Some of the grand ulama have interdicted certain features. We all know that some 25 years or so ago, the highly learned faqih and reference authority, the late Hasheikh Abu Karim Hayri Yazdi, ruled out ta'ziyah in the city of Qom, and he converted a huge demonstration into a simple mourning. Other clergies and scholars have banned, and still do, features that are detrimental to the religion.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear audience. Welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. You know, about the subject of the month of Muharram, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said, keeping the Ashura alive is a very important political and devotional matter. You see, this sentence of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi is addressed to us as a recommendation to keep the movement of Ashura alive. The Shia have made every effort to keep Ashura alive. As you see, for many years and centuries in succession, never have the people following the Prophet's household and believing in Prophet's household forgotten Imam al-Hussein's memory and his name and his burial place and his mourning. Many efforts have been made to encourage people to forget the events of Ashura, but people never did so. You have heard the story of Mutawakkil and his blocking the way to Karbala. They have committed foolish acts and raised foolish objections. Throughout history, they have raised numerous seemingly scientific, emotional, and experiential objects. Nevertheless, Shias have kept them alive and must do so. These tears and mournings that Shia shed and hold are not sadness and tears for the sake of sadness and tears. They are for the sake of the values. Karbala, 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 Allahumma arzuqna Karbala, Karbala, Karbala. The things that lie behind the lamentation, beating the chest and the head and shedding tears are the dearest things that one might find in the treasure trove of humanity, and they are the divine spiritual values. The Shia are trying to uphold the fact that Imam Hussein alayhi salam is the epitome of all these values. The Shia are trying to keep their memories alive. And if the Muslim Ummah keeps Imam Hussein's name and memory alive and follows him, it will overcome all the obstacles and the hardships. Mourning has a symbolic as well as a realistic aspect. It binds hearts together and it broadens knowledge. That is what Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh wanted us to do to keep the rituals of our religion fresh and eternal.
Every night and every day, never forget to say La ilaha
The limelight. The polio virus has been found in sewage samples from Gaza, putting thousands of people living in crowded displaced persons camps at risk of contracting the highly infectious disease that can cause deformities and paralysis. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, the World Health Organization has warned that there was a high risk of the polio virus spreading within and beyond Gaza due to the public health crisis born of the Zionist regime's destruction and siege. The highly infectious virus, mainly affecting children under the age of 5, can invade the nervous system and cause paralysis, according to Reuters. Ideal Sapara Bekov, an official with WHO, said recently, there is a high risk of a spreading of the circulating vaccine-derived polio virus in Gaza, not only because of the detection, but because of the very dire situation with the water sanitation. Sapara Bekov added, it may also spill over internationally at a very high point. WHO Director Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said recently that no paralytic cases have been detected so far in Gaza. Prior to the Zionist regime's current offensive, polio vaccination rates in Gaza were optimal, he said. He warned, however, that the decimation of the health system in the territory, as well as the lack of security, access obstruction, constant population displacement, shortages of medical supplies, poor quality of water, and weakened sanitation are increasing the risk of vaccine-preventable diseases, including polio. The detection of remnants of the polio virus in sewage samples tested in Gaza is only the latest indicator of the severe deterioration of public health conditions in the territory. The catastrophic situation is a predictable, if not intentional, outcome of the Zionist regime's actions in Gaza. In an op-ed published in Ynet in November, Giora Eland, a former Israeli military operations chief and head of the National Security Council, who is currently serving as an advisor to War Minister Yoav Gallant, called for the deprivation of life essentials in Gaza as a means of biological warfare. The official death toll in Gaza since October 7, 2023, surpassed 39,000 recently, including 16,000 children, though the actual number is likely much higher. Thousands of Palestinians remain missing in the rubble or in the streets, or their deaths as a result of secondary mortality such as hunger, thirst, and disease resulting from the Zionist regime's military campaign are not reflected in the fatality count. In a letter published by The Lancet earlier this month, three public health experts conservatively projected that up to 186,000 or even more deaths could be attributable to the current conflict in Gaza. Also recently, the Zionist regime tanks rolled back into Khan Yunis, and at least 70 Palestinians were murdered and 200 injured in artillery shelling and airstrikes in the western areas of the southern Gaza district. The Zionist regime had ordered nearly 500,000 Palestinians in parts of Khan Yunis to leave the area, forcing residents to flee under fire, Reuters reported. One survivor told the news agency that the situation was likely doomsday, with many dead and wounded on the roads. Nasser Medical Complex, the largest hospital in southern Gaza, struggled to cope with the influx of casualties, warning of dire conditions at the facility and issuing an urgent appeal for blood donations. The new Zionist orders encompass part of the so-called safe zone that the military had unilaterally declared in Al-Mawasi, a coastal area west of Khan Yunis, where some 1.7 million people displaced from other areas of Gaza are currently concentrated. The new evacuation orders showed the safe zone to now be around 50 square kilometers, down from just under 59 square kilometers, reducing the area by some 15%. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs stated as of July 22nd, nearly 83% of the Gaza Strip has been placed under evacuation orders or designated as no-go zones by the Zionist regime military. The office added that the frequent evacuation orders and relentless hostilities continue to further devastate Gaza's health system and make it increasingly difficult for repeatedly displaced populations to access essential services, particularly only people suffering from chronic diseases. Only 60 dialysis machines are available to more than 1,500 patients requiring kidney dialysis in Gaza. As a result, patients are undertaking only two dialysis sessions of 2 hours per week instead of the required treatment of 3-4 hour sessions a week, the UN office said. Meanwhile, only 8 partially functioning hospitals and 4 field hospitals are currently providing maternal services, with more than 500,000 women in reproductive age lacking access to antenatal and postnatal care, family planning, and management of transmitted infections, the UN office said. The UN Human Rights Office condemned the latest displacement of Palestinians in Khan Yunis, saying that the new evacuation order was issued in the context of ongoing attacks and gave no time for civilians to know from which areas they were required to leave or where they should go. The UN office said the evacuation order also covered parts of Salahuddin Road, which has been one of two main routes, vital for the transport and distribution of aid, raising concerns that delivery and provision of desperately needed humanitarian assistance will be further reduced or prevented. The office said that the supposed safe zone in Al-Mawasi has little or no infrastructure to support the masses of civilians who have been already displaced there and has been repeatedly subjected to the Zionist regime's artillery fire and airstrikes. The Zionist regime military killed at least 90 Palestinians in Al-Mawasi on July 13 in one of the single deadliest incidents in Gaza since October 7th, while claiming to target Hamas military chief Mohammed Deif. The Zionist regime launched a ground offensive in Khan Yunis earlier this year, ordering residents out of the area and wrecking widespread destruction. At that time, many people fled Khan Yunis to Rafah, which came under evacuation orders in early May. Meanwhile, the Israeli military is escalating its targeting of all aspects and basic elements of life in the Gaza City and North Gaza governorates in an attempt to render them uninhabitable and force their citizens to evacuate to the southern governorates, the Euromed Human Rights Monitor said recently. The group added that The Israeli army opened fire on several women who were cooking and filling water containers in their home in the Sarra neighborhood in northern Gaza, killing 28-year-old Noura al-Sabbagh and injuring several others, one critically. Earlier in the month, on July 2nd, 10 Palestinians, including a child and a disabled person, were killed by Israeli regime artillery fire while they gathered to fill water containers in Az-Zaytun, south of Gaza City. And in late June, 3 Palestinians were martyred when the Zionist regime attacked a group of vendors in downtown Gaza City.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson: compatibility between spiritual life and social activism. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Respected brothers and sisters, this is Sayyid Muhammad Hashimi, and I welcome you to today's, inshallah, thought-provoking lesson. In Islam, we are taught that human beings can ascend to the highest levels of spirituality, manifesting the divine qualities within themselves. This individual evolution is a central aspect of our faith. However, Islam also places great emphasis on social responsibilities and duties. Unlike some other belief systems, Islam does not separate the spiritual realm from the social sphere. Throughout the Quran and the teachings of Prophet and Ahlul Bayt salamullah alayhim ajma'in, we find numerous social practices, laws, and instructions that guide us in our interactions with others and our role in society. Even our acts of worship, such as prayer and fasting, are often congregational, highlighting the importance of community and social engagement. Sadly, throughout history, there have been instances where individuals and communities have attempted to separate the spiritual aspect from social responsibilities. The consequence of this separation has been the decline of Islamic civilization, as we lost the spirit of Islam in daily life and it decreased the power of Islamic Ummah. But the question then arises, how do we reconcile individual spirituality with social righteousness and activism, which is full of distraction? Is there any theory to reconcile between these two? The answer, brothers and sisters, lies in the very foundation of our faith. Islam is completely based on social duties, and there is no inherent conflict between personal spiritual growth and collective social responsibility. But what is the key? The key is to approach both aspects with a mindfulness of Allah and the consciousness of our role as His servants and representatives on earth. If we remain mindful of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in every corner of our life, in the social activity, at home, when you're alone, when you are with other people, you can maintain this consciousness and mindfulness in the social activities. And you can elevate your spirituality even when you are in the society.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.ir.
Welcome back to IRIB English Radio. We were talking about the way of reconciliation between social responsibility and a spiritual ascension. and about the possibility of this. Consider the example of Imam Khomeini, who maintained the deep spiritual connection while actively leading a social and political revolution. He embodied the concept of loneliness among the crowd, remaining steadfast in his principles and mission despite the demands and distractions of the world around him. In our own lives, we can find inspirations in the stories of martyrs and heroes who have walked this path before us. Take, for example, the examples of Shahid Ibrahim Hadi, Shahid Chambran, Shahid Haj Qasim Soleimani, who combined spiritual devotion with social activism, sacrificing their lives for the sake of their faith and their community. Brothers and sisters, the challenge before us is to emulate these great individuals and to strike a balance between our personal spiritual journey and our social responsibilities. We must strive to maintain a strong connection with Allah while actively engaging in the betterment of the society, never losing sight of the ultimate goal of pleasing our Creator and serving His creation. I know it's not easy, but it is possible. If you go to the books of Imam Khomeini like Chehel Hadith, 40 Hadith, or Jihad al-Akbar, you see that he is giving you directions of a spirituality while you are living in the society. This is so important, brothers and sisters. And people like Imam Khomeini are, you know, best examples and best guides in our time to understand this journey, inshallah. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala help us with this, and inshallah we can do and, you know, perform both duties with the help of Allah. Thank you, brothers and sisters. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to IRIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Palestinians who manage to survive the Zionist regime military attacks risk being abducted from their homes and taken from the open-air prison of Gaza to Israeli regime detention and torture centers. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned, please. Middle East Eye wrote, "When darkness falls in Gaza, no one can be certain if they will live out the night. If they do survive this collective punishment, Palestinians also risk being abducted and disappeared from their homes during the night." As the world marked the UN International Day in support of victims of torture on June 26, reports of widespread torture and abuse were emerging from all corners of Gaza and Israeli regime detention and torture centers in the desert. In observance of the occasion, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres stated, "Torturers must never be allowed to get away with their crimes, and systems that enable torture should be dismantled or transformed." Yet the institutions meant to prevent such crimes against humanity are either feckless or indifferent. 37 years after the Convention Against Torture came into effect, violations of human dignity not only persist, but have escalated. In Gaza today, Palestinians are subjected to two types of mass torture. The first is the abduction from their homes by Israeli troops during nighttime military raids, stripping them down of anything that resembles human beings in Israeli regime torture camps. And the second is the infliction of such horrific levels of violence on the entire civilian population that it constitutes torture. It was early February when the Zionist regime launched an incursion into the southern city of Khan Yunis. The Abu Sultan family tried to flee their home during the day, but were not fast enough. Israeli regime tanks had encircled their neighborhood of Al-Amal, sealing off any chance of escape. A group of troops and their menacing dog stormed the home of Sa'de Abu Sultan, an elderly woman who stood frozen in fear in the hallway alongside her brother Muhammad and husband Abdul Karim. In what appears to have become a trend, the dog pounced on 72-year-old Sa'de, savagely mauling her as her brother tried to intervene. Muhammad was shot in the chest and left bleeding on the floor. As confirmed this week in PLUS 972 magazine, the Zionist regime's free-for-all directive allowed troops to open fire and commit summary executions of civilians, a clear violation of the laws of war. In the Abu Sultan home, the troops applied their freedom with vigor, spraying bullets indiscriminately and injuring several family members, including young children, who were taking cover on the ground floor. Amid the pandemonium and terrified screams of women and children, the Zionist regime troops ordered the family to lie down on the ground. The room erupted in gunfire, and the Zionist regime troops detained three of Sa'de's adult children. Her eldest daughter, Nesrin, 52, and her two sons, Hossam, 50, and Muhammad, 45, who was named after his uncle. After an hour of horror, the Zionist regime troops left the house. Bleeding profusely and unable to move, Sa'de's brother Muhammad, who had been sheltering at his sister's home since December 2023, pleaded for medical help. Sa'de did not want to leave her brother behind, but reluctantly agreed to get him emergency care. In a journey that would have normally taken 20 minutes on foot, but extended to an agonizing 4 hours as they dodged bullets and hit from relentless shelling, Sa'de, her sister-in-law, and their children finally reached Nasser Hospital. Fueled by adrenaline and the urgency to save her brother's life, Sa'de couldn't think of the severity of her own injuries. The dog attack had torn the flesh and smashed the bones in her arm, requiring extensive medical treatment, including platinum implants. Although Sa'de immediately notified aid workers from the Red Crescent of Muhammad's dire situation, they were unable to access the area until months later, when the Zionist regime military withdrew from Khan Yunis. By then, Muhammad's body had decomposed in a city left in total ruins. After spending a week in a hospital that was also besieged and violently attacked by Israeli regime forces, Saadeh was discharged from the Nasser Medical Complex. Weeks later, rescuers would unearth hundreds of bodies, including those of children, women, and the elderly, from the courtyard of Khan Yunus Hospital. Saadeh and her surviving family members relocated to Rafah, where her youngest son, Ali, 42, had been sheltering with his in-laws. Her detained children, Nasrin and Mohammed, had endured 3 days of torture and deprivation in an unknown location before being released and joining their family in Rafah, who somehow, however, remained in detention. Overwhelmed with grief over her brother being left to bleed out and ultimately killed for simply trying to protect her and for her abducted son held hostage by the Zionist regime, Saadeh's health rapidly declined. On February 23rd, after the family concluded their Friday prayers, her son Muhammad decided to take her to the hospital along with some of the children with him to help find transportation. When they returned, the house in which they were sheltering in the so-called safe zone of Rafah was targeted in an airstrike, killing Saadeh, her husband Abdul Karim, and her daughter Nasrin. 3 members of the host's family, including 2 women and a child, were also killed, while many others were wounded and rushed to the hospital. Months later, Hossam remains in Israeli regime captivity with no news of his fate or location. His wife and children are imagining the unimaginable.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with a number of young medalists in national and international student and university Olympiads. The meeting took place in the leader's office on June 15th, 2024. This scientific advancement started in the year 2001, but we experienced a bit of a decline in the latter years between 2010 and 2020. I have presented with some statistics, which I have made notes on. I believe this is important. I mean, it's something minor, but it indicates a more significant issue. They say that we won a total of 26 medals, gold medals, in world competitions and international Olympiads between 2018 and 2021, while we have already won 30 gold medals in just 2022 and 23. In other words, we have won more medals in these 2 years than we did in those 4 years. Therefore, a certain movement has taken place in the past 2 or 3 years. However, this is not enough. What we need is a leap in science. You have the potential to truly work and make a difference in this field. You can increase your scientific efforts and help to prepare the environment as well. This is another issue.
دو دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Politics also play a role in these areas. As I mentioned, when the policy of England prevailed and became dominant in the country, which lasted for about 200 years, the dominance of English policy in Iran lasted nearly 200 years, and it was continued later by the US, of course. This was very detrimental to the country. Fortunately, now we have political independence. In other words, Iran or the Islamic Republic has a well-defined logic, opinion, position about general global issues. We have something to say about the issue of Palestine. We have something to say about the issues related to the US. We have something to say about the global matters and the issue of the New World Order. We have something to say in the world. That is, we are saying things that are being heard. The world hears what we say and counts on it. Many may not agree, but people count on what we say. This is independence. We must not lose this. Now, one of the most important issues for any administration that comes to office should be to maintain this political independence that has fortunately been created.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you. Things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
Of Jalali Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah has described as inevitable the retaliation for Israel's killing of the Lebanese movement's top commander, Fuad Shukr.
The enemy and those who are behind it must await our inevitable response. There's no doubt in this regard. The upcoming days and nights, as well as the battlefield, will prove we are working on a real and very calculated response.
During the funeral ceremony of Hezbollah commander Fuad Shukr, who was killed in an Israeli strike on a residential building in a Beirut suburb, Nasrallah underlined that Israel has seriously crossed the red lines. The Hezbollah chief added that the region has entered a new era following the assassination of both Fuad Shukr and head of Hamas political bureau, Ismail Haniyeh, in Tehran. Nasrallah's words resonated strongly among the supporters of the resistance in Lebanon.
We are with the resistance and stand by the resistance. We are the people of the resistance, and this Israeli aggression is not new for us. We're all ready to be martyred.
They are foolish if they think they can weaken our resistance by assassinating our leaders. These assassinations make us stronger. Even if they kill us all, we will not forsake Gaza and the Palestinian cause.
God willing, the oppressors will be punished, and we have full trust in the leadership of the resistance.
We give this gift to the martyrs in Palestine and the children of Palestine and the women of Palestine. Our cause is one. It is the cause of every human being for the sake of humanity and against the enemies of humanity.
Despite the martyrdom of our men from the early years of resistance until now, this movement has become stronger. We will defeat the enemies, Israel and the U.S., thanks to the blood of our martyrs.
The assassination of Hezbollah's commander is expected to set off a new phase of resistance operations, which would show the capabilities of the Lebanese resistance group in the face of Israel's intensified aggression.
The leader of the Lebanese resistance has vowed retaliation for the assassination of top military commander Fuad Shammas. Previous assassinations of Hezbollah commanders has not hindered the movement's determination. So this incident could perhaps make it even more steadfast and powerful. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
In Yemen's capital, Sana'a, the office of the Islamic resistance movement Hamas has become a place of mourning. Leaders and citizens alike are gathering to offer their condolences following the martyrdom of Ismail Haniyeh, head of Hamas political bureau.
Today, all the people of Palestine see Yemen's positions and feel proud and honored and feel that they have support and backing from Yemenis after many leaders and presidents abandoned the Palestinian people and their resistance in this ordeal. Yemen's standing with Palestine raises the morale of the people of Palestine, and they realize that they are not alone, but alongside them are the people of the Yemeni nation, and this motivates the Palestinian people for more resistance and patience amid challenges.
The attendees expressed deep sadness over the loss of what they described as an influential figure in the Palestinian resistance movement. Among them were key Yemeni figures who assured Hamas delegates that Yemen's support for the Palestinian cause remains unwavering. They emphasized that Yemen will continue its backing for the Palestinian resistance until victory is achieved.
The martyrdom of the Arab and Islamic leader Ismail Haniyeh was a great shock to the Palestinian people and the Arab people as a whole. There is a great pain, especially since this man was the most prominent unifying figure within the movement, as he was very cooperative with other Palestinian factions. Haniyeh's martyrdom will unite the Palestinian resistance more and will push for greater steadfastness.
Abdul Malik al-Houthi, leader of the Ansarullah movement, vowed to avenge Haniyeh's martyrdom. Al-Houthi pledged full cooperation with resistance forces across the region, declaring that no effort will be spared in seeking retribution for Haniyeh and other martyrs. He warned that the targeting of resistance leaders has escalated the conflict and that such actions will have severe repercussions for the Israeli regime and its allies.
Observers say the solidarity shown in Yemen reflects broader regional support for the Palestinian resistance and underscores the ramifications of Haniyeh's martyrdom on the region, signaling potential escalations in already tense and turbulent West Asia. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
Turkish Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan suggested in an interview with Turkish broadcaster Channel 7 that forming a regional security alliance in West Asia could help stabilize the area. The top diplomat said the security pact will forge a trust among regional countries and prevent unnecessary interventions from outside.
We do not want to remain a country that only sees and describes the problem in the region. We also care about bringing real, applicable solutions to them. This is not the first war, nor the last. But one thing is important. We must develop a capability and capacity to be ready for any kind of struggle.
Hakan did not specify which countries would be involved in the pact, but analysts say the potential alliance will include as many West Asian countries as possible.
I believe that forming a security alliance in the region will enhance political and military coordination among the countries of the region, which they currently lack. This is not a new idea, as we have previously heard about plans to establish an Arab or regional alliance like NATO to serve the interests of the West Asia. As for the countries involved, the minister did not mention any specific names, but I believe the alliance will aim to include as many West Asian countries as possible, especially those surrounding Palestine.
Turkey is already part of a security alliance, which is US-led NATO. However, it seems that there are conflicting interests among the bloc's member states in various issues. Therefore, Ankara seems to be trying to initiate new alliances.
I don't think the regional security alliance would affect NATO, as each alliance has its own geographic scope and specific objectives.
Turkey has been recently making concerted effort to strengthen ties with regional countries. This was evident from Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's latest meetings with high-ranking regional officials, including from Iran and Egypt. He also called for a meeting with his Syrian counterpart after years of severed ties. Last week, Turkish Foreign Minister said Ankara is seeking stronger ties with Arab countries, including Syria and Egypt. It appears that Turkey is now focusing on strengthening ties with regional countries instead of seeking Western acceptance of its role as a regional power. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Demonstrations took place in numerous cities, including the capital Islamabad, where a funeral prayer in absentia was offered for the slain leader.